Hey, Peter.
Hey, John, how you doing?
I'm good. It's been a long time since we haven't seen each other over the web.
It's true. I know. I'm glad to be back doing it again.
As am I, and remains to be seen whether the viewers are glad to have you back, but that's their problem.
That's right.
Should we just get started?
Let's go started. Why don't you start it off?
Okay. Almost slipped back into the old ways.
That's right.
So the budget. Barack Obama has got this just outrageously enormous budget. What is it? $3.8 trillion for 2010. There's more debt in it more deficit spending in it than all of Bush's deficits combined, as I understand it, or something close to that. We're going to be spending something like 46 or 50 cents out of every dollar on our credit cards. And I think it's bad, and I think a lot of conservatives think it's bad, and a lot of Republicans think it's bad. And yet anytime anybody ever mentions it on the right, anytime any of us complain about it, we hear this response made with various degrees of subtlety and intelligence, you know, from one end of the spectrum, something like what Janine Garofalo might say, and from the other end, something like what you might say. But the commonality between them is this idea that somehow, because conservatives didn't complain enough about the budget about the deficit spending and whatnot under Bush, they have no right to complain now. And I have two problems with this. First of all, there's a factual assertion there that I think, while it certainly has a lot of truth to it, is often actually exaggerated. National Review, myself, I went back and found a speech I gave to the New York Conservative Party and that I put online at the time from late 2003 or early 2004, just tearing into Bush about his spending. And I've written many columns criticizing him. Lots of people at National Review had criticized Bush on the spending, not as many people at the Weekly Standard, but my only point is I'm willing to concede the basic point that conservatives didn't complain enough, and that certainly Republicans in the House didn't do anywhere close to near enough to restrain spending and all of the rest, but I think that part is exaggerated. What bothers me more is the logic here, because if you want to make the case that conservatives are hypocrites for complaining about Obama's spending but not Bush's, you also have to make the case that liberals are hypocrites for complaining about overspending under Bush, but celebrating overspending under Obama. The hypocrisy charge, like with most of these things, cuts both ways. Moreover, there's a difference in scale here. Obama's spending vastly dwarfs what Bush's spending was, or the spending under Bush was. Called Democratic spending, if you prefer, versus Republican spending. It's orders of magnitude larger. And to say that somehow because Republicans didn't complain enough about or didn't object enough to Bush playing with matches, they can't complain about Obama, you know, playing with blowtorches. I mean, there's a scale issue here. And when you add in a third factor, just to throw it in, just to keep things interesting, you add in a third factor that Obama is doing this amazing bait and switch where he's constantly talking about how we need to get out of this financial crisis, we need to get out of, you know, we need to solve this Wall Street mess and all of the rest. And then he almost immediately elides into why we need to spend billions or trillions on healthcare, energy, and to some extent education. None of these things, whatever their merits, have anything to do with getting us out of the financial crisis. So those are my gripes.
Okay, well, I guess it seems to me, you know, I start from the view that most people are hypocrites about most things. So the hypocrisy charge in itself doesn't bother me. But I think that if you're comparing Bush's spending to Obama's spending, the first there's a when question, right? I mean, Obama is clearly this spending that Obama is spending a huge amount of money, much, much more than I think the Obama people ever thought they would. And a lot of that spending is done basically because they believe that we're in a crisis moment that calls for kind of massive amounts of Keynesianism. So we're basically monetary policy is going at full throttle and fiscal policy is going at full throttle. So it seems to be a pretty basic, when starters, a pretty basic difference between the Bush spending, at least the Bush spending. Now, maybe you could say right at the beginning after in 2001 and after 9/11, the Bush people kind of justified their spending and tax cutting as trying to get us out of that comparatively mild recession. But I think that if you're a Keynesian, and I kind of thought that a lot of Republicans kind of were these days, that that there is a fundamental difference between spending a huge amount of money when the economy is in a ditch like it is now and spending it in normal times, partly because, and this is the argument that Krugman and lots of other people make, because, in fact, if you don't spend any money, the devastation of the economy may mean that revenue is so low that, in fact, you have huge budget deficit problems anyway. So that seems to be a pretty important conceptual difference between the second point, and then you can...
That's an argument about, just for the record, that's an argument about the stimulus bill that is not an argument for his budget. These are different things.
It's definitely an argument for the stimulus bill. I mean, I agree that Obama is using this moment to try to make longer-term changes. And I actually don't even think he's been dishonest about that. I mean, I think he's basically said that, basically, look, we have to make these, what he would call, whatever, long-term investments, because he basically thinks they're big, long-term structural problems with the economy and in issues like health care and energy and the environment that he wants to solve. And he would be trying to do this anyway. I mean, I think what we do know about Obama is that he would have been trying to spend a lot of money in the short term on health care and probably on energy environment, even without this financial crisis. The financial crisis in some ways makes it easier for him, you could argue, politically. In some ways, you could argue makes it harder for him. But, there's not a bait and switch here. He's basically said for a long time, as almost all Democrats, that they want a big push on health care. They're making a big push on health care.
He also promised the net spending cut, right? I mean, and that's nowhere close to operative, right?
Well, I think in this environment, I think a net spending cut would have been, you know, wouldn't have made any sense. It would have been the equivalent of the dumbest thing that Franklin Roosevelt tried to do when Franklin Roosevelt was going.
I agree with that, but Peter, I think you're giving him way too much of a benefit of the doubt when you say that he's being totally above board and honest about this, because, I mean, I can go and find the clips for you in several speeches, numerous important, grave speeches. He has made implicitly and at times explicitly the case that what he's doing on health care and the environment and all the rest, and his new foundation speech at Georgetown, he's trying to make the case that dealing with these things will not only deal with the financial crisis, but prevent another financial
crisis. But I think that's a different
point. That's nonsense.
I mean,
right?
I think the way I hear him, at least, and I don't have the quotes in front of me, is that basically he's arguing that we have to get out of this ditch, but then there are basically also these fundamental problems with the way our economy is set up that have to be dealt with, or else we're going to get ourselves, or else we're going to have other kinds of big problems in the future. And, you know, look, I mean, let's not be naive here. Every politician, a president, will try to use a crisis. We'll use whatever they can to try to make the longer-term changes in the political economy that they believe are best for the country. I mean, obviously, a Republican president would have tried to take advantage of this moment in various other ways. I mean, it seems to me it's hardly a kind of sinister thing. You may think that the policy substance is sinister, but the taking advantage of a crisis to try to make big long-term changes that you want to make, just as FDR did, just as in a way Bush did after 9/11, is naturally what politicians do.
Peter, if that's the point you want to make, and I could argue with you about it, because I think, you know, my thinking on this has changed quite a bit after writing my book. I think exploiting crises is fine if they're to deal with, if you deal with the crisis. I think it's fundamentally undemocratic to use crises to force changes down people's throats.
I mean, Barack Obama, first, Democrats have been calling health care a crisis for decades now. Barack Obama ran on that, and he won a big victory.
Yeah,
I mean, what's
something
democratic about that?
I'm saying as a generic proposition, to the way Rahm Emanuel and others formulate it, that you want to use a crisis to do things you couldn't otherwise do, it is, to me, undemocratic. And I'm glad to argue about that as a separate section, and that's all fine. But
yeah,
because,
I mean, I don't
when
think
Republicans
that,
do it, a lot of people, including you, when Bush or conservatives do it, if your point is that this is what politicians do, I'm willing to concede that point. But when conservatives do it, I bet I could find the examples of it, and other people in the New Republic, to be sure, have used this exact same point as an accusation, a sinister accusation about conservatives. So what bothers me is this blasé, this is what politicians do, and there's nothing sinister about it when Democrats do it, but for some reason when conservatives do it, it is this.
No. My point is that what makes it sinister is the nature of the response to the crisis, whether in fact you think that it's actually a rational and intelligent use of the political capital you have at the moment. So George W. Bush used the
healthcare. How is tackling healthcare a response to the financial crisis?
No, I didn't say that. I said that I disagree with your larger point that basically politicians can't use crises to try to push longer-term agendas. But that's basically the way that most big changes take place. You know, Ronald Reagan came in, and it would be very hard to argue, I think, that everything that Ronald Reagan did on the economic front was specifically a crisis to the financial difficulties of the late 1970s. Reagan had a set of views that he had formed long before the difficulties of the Carter years, that he basically then used his political strength and the dissatisfaction with Democratic economic policies to then push through a very large agenda, that I think we would have a whole extremely difficult time matching up specifically with the particular set of problems that we had that he faced in early 1981. And Bush did that after 9/11, he took 9/11, he directed the American public's attention to Afghanistan, which I think was a useful way of responding. Then he directed the public's attention to Iraq, which I think was a stupid way of responding. But he was dealing with I don't have a problem with him using that to deal with what he thought about were longer-term problems. But I do have a problem with him using it to respond in a way that I think did the country ill.
I have no problem with that argument. I just think the problem – my objection to what you're saying is it sounds to me like you're trying to have it both ways, where you're trying to say that Obama is dealing with health care because he ran on health care and he has a mandate to deal with health care, which in a vacuum I think is an absolutely fair point. I mean, the guy basically ran on doing something dramatic with health care. I think he was minimalist in describing his real ambitions on healthcare during the campaign, but he won. The Democrats won. They're in charge. They get to try to do what they want on healthcare. That's fine, except for the fact that Obama is also arguing that coping with the financial crisis makes dealing with healthcare all the more necessary, and I think that is dishonest. I think that is. Gets closer to what I was talking about in terms of, as a generic proposition, the undemocratic, aspect of all of this. If you're going to, it reminds me of, the complaint I often heard from you and Jonathan Chait and others about Republicans, which I always thought had some bite, that when times were good, Republicans called for tax cuts because we needed to get the surpluses out of Washington. And when times were bad, we needed tax cuts because we needed to jumpstart the economy. So no matter what the situation was, we always just needed tax cuts. It seems to me that before the financial crisis, everyone was talking about how we needed health care. And after the financial crisis, the same people are now saying, aha, this shows that we really need health care.
The difference is that while you may be able to find an example of Obama or some Democrat basically connecting this to the financial crisis, the main thrust of the argument for health care way precedes the financial crisis and has an independent life from the financial crisis. I mean, and the evidence of that is that we know that Obama would be pushing it even without the financial crisis, and that Bill Clinton tried it within a situation that wasn't part of the financial crisis. So I think that what you're harping on is a rather small part of a pretty obvious story about basically Obama trying to do what he was already doing, to some degree encumbered by the financial crisis because it becomes harder because we go so much into debt because of the stimulus spending, and in some ways empowered by it because I think it's part of the reason for his greater strength. But I want to make one other point about this that I wanted to get to, which is just I think the other it seems to me important thing about this question about deficits is, I mean, it's an obvious point, but I think it's worth stating, doesn't get stated enough. I don't think Republicans have, and have had since Ronald Reagan, a fundamental overriding opposition to deficits. I think they have been concerned about deficits, but there's been certain kinds of spending and tax cutting that they have thought was so valuable that they were willing to support it even if it led to deficits. And Democrats similarly. So neither party basically prioritizes deficits. Both of them have certain things that are more important to them than deficits. And so that's the important thing, is that the big increases in Bush spending were on defense and homeland security. I mean, entitlement spending also went up, because it just naturally goes up, unless it's not discretionary. It goes up every year according to a formula.
But well, there was a prescription drug benefit, right, which was...
The prescription drug benefit, although, again, I think that has to, our understanding that has to be complicated by the fact that Bush was trying to use that to basically, get the private sector into the distribution of, into the Medicare system, which I think in the long term, I think a lot of conservatives felt was a pretty important way of trying to basically partially privatize it. So, but I mean, I think that the question I have, it seems to me, for Republicans is, do Republicans still believe that spending a lot of money on defense and homeland security is worth doing even in cases of deficit? Because it seems to me that was, in a lot of ways, the really important fundamental choice in the Bush years, along with the question of whether you're willing to pass big tax cuts that would increase the deficit. The Democrats would say probably no, most of them, but Democrats would say, yeah, we're willing to spend more on health care if it's going to increase the deficit.
I think that's largely right. But, again, there are differences of degree, and, differences of degree can become differences in kind. There are no shortage of foaming at the mouth, outraged quotes from leading Democrats about how outrageously large George Bush's deficits were at $400 billion, $500 billion, $600 billion. And when you now triple those or quadruple those, or over if you do over the 10-year projections, increase them by tenfold or whatever these crazy numbers are, then it seems to me that even though you're spending for your own priorities instead of Republican priorities, at some point something should kick in and say, hey, wait a second, if I really thought that Bush's outrageous and scandalous $500 billion budget was terrible, maybe even though it's going towards health care, a $1.5 trillion deficit is bad too. And there's no sense of that sort of awareness.
Well, but I mean, it's partly about the fact that we're doing it, that it's happening in the midst of this financial crisis. And the stimulus bill just simply wouldn't exist without the financial crisis. So I think that, there is a little bit of an apples and oranges discussion is simply comparing the number of the budget deficit you had under Bush to the number you had under Obama. But look, even Obama, I think, has been, fairly explicit in laying down a marker in basically saying that we're going to have to reduce the deficit. Obama is not Hubert Humphrey in the 1960s basically saying, we can sustain unlimited deficits. He's basically, interesting way, I think, kind of laying down the marker, I think, for potentially some move on entitlement. And if you look, people like Peter Orszag are actual kind of maniacs about healthcare spending in particular. So I don't think you're being quite fair enough when you act as if basically the Democrats, first of all, I think partly they're doing it because I think they're trying to send a message to China, that they need the Chinese to know that we're basically not going to run these deficits forever. But I think there actually is quite an awareness that basically the deficits are going to have to come down. I think the politics of that are going to get really tough for the Obama administration when they try to do it. But they're clearly setting down a marker that they're going to try to do it.
We shall see about it. But my last point about this is that there's something that has been bugging me since the start of this conversation. If the financial crisis – I mean, the whole point of a crisis, right, is the whole argument, the internal consistent logic of a crisis. A kid falls down a well, right? Everyone in the town drops what they're doing, and makes painful sacrifices of at least their time and labor and runs to go help, right? I mean, this is the inherent logic of the moral equivalent of war, right, that everyone the inherent logic of the never waste a crisis thing is that people – will bend the rules and drop what they're doing and rally around to deal with the crisis. And yet your entire thing about how he's going after healthcare amidst the financial crisis makes it, inflates these budget numbers and all this. If the financial crisis is a crisis, then doesn't the internal logic of what a crisis is require that you put off doing other things at some point, that you say, okay, this is where the fire is. We have to do what it takes to put out this fire. And yet you give them a free pass for going after healthcare and all these other things, even though they blow up the deficit and they distract from dealing with the crisis.
No.
Or they have nothing to do with dealing with the crisis.
No, I don't think that's right. We're not saying that we should pull out of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan because we have to deal with the financial crisis. I mean, we should stop doing things during the financial crisis that make the financial crisis worse. But you don't have a responsibility, it seems to me, to basically stop focusing on all other concerns that you may have because there's a financial crisis. I mean, most of Obama's early efforts were specifically designed to deal with aspects of the financial crisis, the stimulus bill and the bank stuff and the mortgage stuff and blah, blah, blah. And he's also now pursuing this agenda. If you can make the argument to be this agenda is basically is undermining the effort to deal with a financial crisis, it's one thing. But there are all kinds of things that Obama has to do to govern, including he has the right to pursue an agenda that he was elected on, which, you know,
It's just nonsense. Even the stimulus bill. I mean, most of the spending in the stimulus bill doesn't kick in until 2010, 2011, 2012. Something like 70% of it occurs after Obama projects that the economy is going to be roaring at 3.5%. It has all to do with wish fulfillment of the existing Democratic agenda.
No, I don't think that's fair at all. First of all, it takes a little bit of time to spend money, and a lot of people, and there is some reason to believe that we're going to be feeling the effects of the financial crisis for quite a while. And even if it takes time for money to say get to the states, that means the states know that they're going to get the money. It means that they may not make as savage cuts right now in their budgets, cuts that would really make this recession, the financial crisis much worse. And, it's funny, when the stock market was going way, way down right at the beginning of the Obama administration, I couldn't turn on Fox but to hear that basically this was a negative referendum. It seems to me if you're going to play that game, which Republicans were playing en masse, you then have to maybe at least contemplate the idea that the fact that we seem perhaps to be bottoming out of this recession much faster than people thought suggests that, gosh, maybe something Obama did is actually having some positive benefit.
It's entirely possible. It's also possible that when you start pouring trillions of dollars into an economy, like we saw with FDR, you come out, you sort of stimulative effect for a short while, and then you have a second dip recession, which... Or worse.
If you basically turn around economically and try to balance the budget like FDR did, but I don't think Obama's going to do that right away.
Not right away, but at some point he's going to have. We can't keep continuously spend 50 cents out of every dollar, in debt, in deficit spending.
No, but anyway. I think that the hope is that we can be out of this depression/recession by the time we start that effort. I mean, it's a difficult balancing act, but I think I don't see a better alternative than that. Well, let's move on to topic number two.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
We may agree even more on this one. Obama's got the Supreme Court pick coming up, and he said, I don't know the exact quote, but he said he wants somebody who has kind of life experience, whose life experience leads them to be able to understand the underprivileged. It was kind of in that vein, right?
Needs empathy.
The person wants empathy. I think this is a mistake, and I think this is a kind of a mistake that liberals commonly make, which is to say that I might buy the idea. In fact, I do buy the idea that on average, someone who has experienced poverty and discrimination is probably more likely to end up on the liberal side of the ledger, on average. But the reality is that people are just far, far too complicated to take any particular set of political ideologies based on their own experience. Clarence Thomas is the guy who suffered most on this Supreme Court, and Franklin Roosevelt grew up with a toy yacht, and Herbert Hoover was orphaned at the age of 9. I think it's silly when liberals and like Obama basically want liberals, and I think they have every right to want liberals. So do I. But basically, instead of saying that what they want is people who have liberal views, they basically say we want people who suffered. If they've suffered and they have liberal views, that's great. But I would much, much rather have someone like Franklin Roosevelt, who grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth, and for whatever complicated series of reasons, basically is on the left, than someone like Clarence Thomas, who had hell to pay in his life and basically turned it into an ideology of a kind of rugged individualism that I think is really lousy. And I think it's unfortunate that we still have this idea that identity or that experience translates in a simple way into political ideology. Because we all know, if we think about the people we actually know in our lives and other individuals, that people are just more complicated than that.
Well, I was so ready to say, wow, you said it all for me, and let's move on to the next topic, because I agree with you entirely on your point about psychology and personal experience and all of the rest. I mean, Ted Kennedy had the entire world handed to him, and and he is a bleeding heart liberal, you know. And you're right, Clarence Thomas has a better personal story than anyone else on the Supreme Court, and you guys think he's, you know, the devil. So I think that's a perfectly valid and insightful point and all the rest. But at some point in there, you took a wrong turn, and I got really upset about it. So your objection isn't to the idea that we should have a touchy-feely, empathetic Supreme Court justice. Your objection is to the idea that somehow one's personal narrative will dictate that touchy-feely empathy, right? I mean, you don't mind the idea that we have to have someone who takes it as part of his job description as a Supreme Court justice to give the benefit of the doubt or to let his empathy for single moms and poor people influence his rulings. You just don't think that it's a necessarily good rule of thumb to say that because you grew up poor or a single mom that you're going to share those feelings, right? I mean, that's your basic point?
The empathy is not the word that I would use. I don't necessarily know if Stephen Breyer or Ruth Bader Ginsburg or David Souter are particularly more empathetic. It seems to me they have a view of they in general tend to have a view about jurisprudence that I prefer, that I think is better for society. So you know, if you want to call it empathy, you can call it empathy. I'm not necessarily empathy suggests a kind of a personal kind of affinity, and I'm not necessarily sure these individuals have more of a personal affinity. I just happen to think that their ideology is just more in line with mine.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, like David Souter is, you know, a hermit who basically lives in the woods reading Proust or something, and you guys love him. Okay, well, here's my problem, because I that is what Obama has called for in the past. If you read his speech, I think it was to NARAL, a couple years ago, He goes on in great length about the importance of a living constitution, of the importance of empathy, of sharing the of having a connection to the personal experience of being, you know, poor or minority and all these sorts of things, and in his recent comments he said something along those lines as well about how empathy is the shorthand word, you know, that has come out of this. And my problem with this is simply that, while I don't think conservatives should go too high on the hog, you know, saying empathy sucks or anything like that, I just don't think that's a great position for, you know, a political movement or a political party. This begs the question, what are Supreme Court justices for? And I don't have it memorized, but the Supreme Court justice's oath, I'm pretty sure, goes on at considerable length about how you're not supposed to have you're not supposed to favor anybody because of their objective class standing or where they come from or anything like that. I mean, that's the whole reason justice is blind, right? And you read people like Dahlia Lithwick and others who seem to take great offense at this, this sort of the position popularized by John Roberts that justices should be umpires. But it seems to me that's what they should be. And I'm not saying that you can't, you know, have, you know, that empathy can play no role. But if you read, you know, what Obama has said about the living constitution in the past, basically it certainly sounds like what he is saying is that the constitution should basically become this writ for do-goodery, for helping the oppressed, for feeding the hungry, for all the rest. And while those are obviously noble and decent causes and worthwhile reasons to go into politics and all the rest, it's not the job of a Supreme Court justice to do that. The Supreme Court is there to deal with the law and the Constitution, and the legislative branch and the executive branch, being the political branches, are supposed to be doing these high and lofty and noble things, and we're supposed to be able to debate these things as a people and vote on them. And it seems to me that this basic criticism of progressivism and liberalism for the last century in terms of the Supreme Court is that if the Supreme Court can do the right thing, not necessarily the constitutional thing or the legal, but just the right thing, it should always do it. And that seems to me where Obama is coming from, and that would be my primary objection to whoever he picks for the Supreme Court, be they from humble origins or from, you know, a mansion.
I mean, look, I agree that Supreme Court justices should try to have certain ideas about what they think is constitutional, and they should follow those ideas without regard, without trying to basically focus on what the policy outcome is. What I just find, though, just kind of laughable is, you know, and again, I have to say, I always say this when we have this conversation, but it's just because it's always the elephant in the room for me, because something kind of for me, I still live in the post-Gore v. World, you know, Bush v. Gore world. The idea to me that conservatives have any particular special claim to be less concerned about the policy outcomes of their judicial decisions, it just strikes me as laughable. So, I mean, you know,
I know that's your position, but I find it really very silly that this is the where almost every liberal goes after three generations of the Supreme Court turning into a legislative branch, bending laws to, you know, a progressive agenda and arguing that they should be citing foreign law, that you go back to Bush v. Gore every time to say, well, everybody does it?
What about the court in the early 20th century was consistently striking down legislation passed by Congress? I mean, you celebrate that? I mean, the conservatives have at least as long a history as the liberals on the Supreme Court of basically pursuing their own political and economic ideology from the bench. Jeff Rosen writes about this, someone who's actually genuinely committed to this principle of not trying to legislate from the bench, spilled hundreds of thousands of words of ink in the Scalia era, talking about how basically conservatives having attacked liberals for doing this. So Bush v. Gore is just the most obvious case. But, I mean, the idea that it's confined to Bush v. Gore that's what I think is silly. I mean, I think conservatives do it constantly.
Well, first of all, I'm glad that we established in the first segment of this conversation that you don't think hypocrisy is a useful or interesting point when it comes to these political debates. But on the issue of the 1920 Supreme Court, it kind of does depend to a certain extent on what Congress was trying to do, right? I mean, some things I'm forgiving Congress a great deal of latitude, but I'm not forgiving it latitude to violate the Constitution.
Well,
that's what the Supreme Court is supposed to do, right? Is protect people from violating the Constitution.
It turns out that another group of Supreme Court justices didn't think that that kind of legislation violated the Constitution. I mean, not just in the 30s, but also in the first decade of the 20th century. I mean, it turned out shockingly that different group of Supreme Court justices had a different interpretation of what was okay under the Constitution.
Yeah, and some were probably right and some were probably wrong. I mean, there is an answer, right? I mean, I think that sometimes...
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, go on. I'm sorry, go on.
No. There is an answer, but it seems to me that one should strive to have ideas about jurisprudence that are not based on what particular policy outcome will occur. But it seems to me that while we can agree that that's an ideal, I think it seems to me that what bothers me is the implication that somehow it's only on the left that this happens. Whereas it seems to me actually human beings being human beings, there's often been a pretty good people like Alito and Roberts and Scalia basically have classic kind of conservative. I mean, they basically came of age and had classic kind of conservative ideas, which they basically took with them onto the bench. It's not a coincidence that they have the view of the Constitution that they do. It's not disconnected from their policy views, as far as I can tell. Right. Having read the bio, you know, reading the stories about them, you know, they didn't serve in Democratic administration. These guys, right?
Yeah, but I mean. But, look, Peter, at a very high level of generalization, I think it is objectively true that liberals believe in the concept of a living constitution. Hillary Clinton has said it time and again that she believes in a constitution that adapts and changes with society. Al Gore has said expressly that. Barack Obama has said expressly that. And that's a liberal position going back to Woodrow Wilson. Conservatives don't believe that. And so, therefore, it's not shocking that when you put conservatives on the court, they are not going to act on the presumption that the Supreme Court should be out there reading into the Constitution things that are not there. And
neither
of us are constitutional scholars, but I think if you put the record of, say, Breyer or Ginsburg up against Thomas or Scalia, I think most objective Supreme Court watchers would make the case that maybe, yes, Scalia and Thomas have made mistakes or not been entirely persistent in the, or consistent in their or persuasive in their argument about applying their ideology, but the idea that somehow Scalia and Thomas are as bad at reading into the Constitution things that aren't in the Constitution as, say, Breyer and Ginsburg strikes me as just untenable.
Yeah, but I mean, Jonah, all of this is based on the idea that, somehow we could agree on what's in the Constitution and what's not in the Constitution should be read into it. I mean, the whole point of it, is that nobody can agree on that point. I mean, there is not, you can't simply say, well, you know, there's an objective understanding of what's in the Constitution, and liberals basically won't conform to that objective standard of the in the Constitution.
Well, but I also don't think, you know, that you can make the case very persuasively that people like Scalia and Thomas don't try harder to figure out what the founders, what the language, what the history of the Constitution and its intent and its meaning is. They don't try harder to figure that out than liberals who go quoting foreign polls, foreign constitutions, foreign courts, you know, conclusions, and brag about how they do that. It seems to me that this is a fairly easy standard by which to judge the two sides. And maybe they do it, one side does it better than the other, or both sides make mistakes and all of the rest. But it seems to me that what you're doing is this sort of classic debater's trick about the Constitution. Since we can never come to a consensus on exactly what the Constitution means, it in fact means anything that we bring to it. And I don't think that's a legitimate argument.
I certainly don't think that it believes anything we bring to it. Not at all. But I also don't think that, you know, and neither you nor I are constitutional scholars, but we both know that there are very, very serious people who argue that there are ways of interpreting the Constitution other than simply original intent. I mean, and so to kind of act as if basically anything else is the equivalent of basically just throwing in there whatever you want because you think it's going to make the world a better place, I just think is a little simplistic.
Well, all I know is what's the name of Obama's friend from the University of Chicago who's now in the
Cass Sunstein?
Yeah, I mean, Cass Sunstein has argued, and I think Cass Sunstein's a brilliant guy, and from all accounts, he's a very nice guy and all the rest. At the same time, you know, Sunstein makes these arguments about how we should read into the Constitution FDR's Economic Bill of Rights. Now, that seems to me to be something that almost every liberal, even if they may not defend it, will have some sympathy for, and almost every conservative will have very little sympathy for. And these are
Do you think Breyer and Ginsburg believe that the Constitution guarantees a right to a job?
No, not necessarily.
I mean, I don't think they believe that at all. I mean, welfare reform was not judged unconstitutional, was it?
How did they vote on it?
I think by some reckonings, a pretty significant executive and legislative kind of effort to scale back parts of the welfare state, and I don't see the Supreme Court really having stood in the way.
No, I think that's fair. If your argument is that the liberal wing of the Supreme Court could be worse, I'm with you.
Anyway, I just don't really believe that most liberals believe that there is I think they would like to enact legislatively a lot of stuff that would have been an FDR's Bill of Rights. But I just don't believe that anyone who Obama is considering nominating or is on the court already basically believes that's in the Supreme Court, that is in the Constitution now, as far as I can tell.
No, I think that's fair. And there's lots of argument, and Jeffrey Rosen made this case, that the Supreme Court's actually more pro-corporate as a body than almost any other Supreme Court, because all these guys come out of that corporate, even the liberals come out of that corporate background.
Yeah, I mean, Breyer was a deregulator under Carter. I mean, that's what made his name, is Kennedy's counsel.
Right. That's all fair. But what we're talking about is a general proposition about, you know, it seems to me you want to be awfully even-handed in criticism of left or right about their attitude towards the Constitution, and I think the attitude towards the Constitution between left and right is actually very different.
Well, I think there are important differences, but where I'm disagreeing with is your conflation of original intent with basically, you know, the people who believe in original intent believe in basically trying to figure out what's in the Constitution. The people who don't believe in original intent basically believe in, you know, taking whatever they like and basically calling it constitutional.
And I would say that people who believe in original intent care more about figuring out what's in the Constitution than people who quote foreign polls and foreign courts to figure out what our Constitution means.
All right. Well, I will. Let's go on to the third topic. There were two quotes that I came across recently apropos of nothing that I thought were kind of interesting in terms of helpful and kind of helping to understand what liberalism and conservatism mean. And the first came from George Will talking about Ronald Reagan. Will, you know, in the late 80s was very tough on, very critical of Reagan, particularly on his relationship with Gorbachev, and as a lot of conservatives were. And Will said that Reagan is painfully fond of the least conservative sentiment conceivable, a statement from an anti-conservative Thomas Paine, quote, "We have it in our power to begin the world again," unquote. And then Will goes on to say, "Any time, any place, that is nonsense." I thought that statement of what conservatism most fundamentally is not, which is the idea that we have the power to begin the world again, was a really, for me, very helpful kind of way of thinking about what it means to be a conservative, and I thought I would see what you thought of it.
I agree with that entirely. I think some of Reagan's rhetoric on those fronts, I forgive a lot of it because it has to do with a very specific context, uh-huh. and it wasn't tied to what is historically a sort of Jacobin desire to rewrite, to truly rewrite institutions. Uh-huh. What Reagan was talking about was in a global context of changing the, you know, of sort of getting a do-over since the beginning of the Cold War. So I find it a little forgivable. But in the plain text reading, I'm entirely with Will. I think that this is the sort of the fundamental insight of conservatism is that you cannot create new men. One of my favorite definitions of conservatism, which I think Glenn Lowry actually, I first got it from him years ago, is this idea that human nature has no history. That is what conservatism believes. And so you cannot create new men, ergo you cannot create new societies, you cannot start from year zero, which was the ambition of the Jacobins, the Nazis, the Soviets, and all of the rest. You cannot create a heaven on earth. This is what the philosopher Eric Voegelin called immanentizing the eschaton, the idea of taking what is reserved for the hereafter and bringing it down to the here and now, of creating a heaven on earth, which was the rallying cry of utopian sort of year zero movements throughout the 20th century. And if you give a hard reading to what Reagan is saying there, I think that Will is exactly right in that Reagan, if Reagan meant that, it would bother me a lot more, but I don't really believe that Reagan was eager to turn, you know, churches into stables and, you know, and take children away from their families or any of that kind of stuff, the things that people like, you know, Robespierre actually did believe in.
Yeah, but it does raise the question of, I mean, look, I think there's a lot of value in what you're saying, and in fact a lot of the kind of liberalism that tends to emerge in the middle of the 20th century, you know, the liberalism of say Reinhold Niebuhr, is very sympathetic to that point of view. But it does, I think, it does raise the question of whether conservatives, by basically taking that position, don't open themselves up to the possibility of radical, dramatic kind of changes for the good, dramatic kind of progress that takes place in a very, very short period of time, in a very radical kind of disjuncture with the past. And so that...
Are you trying not to say the word revolution?
Well, I mean, in a way, I think there are times when I think a revolution is, I mean, again, we can debate what's a revolution, right? But I guess I wasn't thinking about a revolution. What I was thinking about was, in fact, Reagan's ability to imagine that something which I think was very unconservative, which is that basically the Soviet Union and communism, as we've known for a very, very long time, which had built up in the Cold War, which had been a very stable part of the kind of world for 50 years, could basically, if he made some really bold moves, could basically dramatically change overnight, as long as we were able to imagine the possibility of that dramatic change and take real risks for it. And I think that was, in many ways, a kind of a quite unconservative, and it's not surprising that it was threatening to George Will, even though, yes, it did not involve a French Revolution and turning the clocks back to zero. It was the ability to imagine, conservatives tend to like slow, orderly change with kind of trembling and reverence for what happened in the past. But it seems to me there you could make an argument that it's that perspective that sometimes leads conservatives to not be able to imagine the possibility of very necessary, dramatic, fundamental, short-term change, which is what Reagan was able to imagine when he imagined the end of the Cold War. And to some degree, I think you could argue it's what someone like Martin Luther King was able to imagine when he imagined, hundreds of years of discrimination against African Americans basically being overcome by legislation in a very, very short period of time, rather than waiting for attitudes to change and all that kind of thing.
I think that's an entirely fair point. I mean, I think that when you actually get out into the world of practical politics, some of that ideological stuff melts away. I mean, no one would, with the exception of it, I don't know if we've ever discussed the book, but, John Patrick Diggins, one of the last books he wrote before he died, made this sweeping case that Reagan was a liberal.
Yeah.
And for a lot of the sort of stuff that you're getting at. Mm-hmm. And but most people, I think it's fair to say, still consider Reagan a pretty doctrinaire conservative, at least until he actually was faced with governing choices. And then you get into this, was Reagan a pragmatist or not, and all that kind of stuff. And Chait makes this big case that Reagan was a pragmatist and all that, which I'm open to. So I think that when you actually get politicians in power and they're faced with actual choices and their desire for a legacy and doing good for the country, regardless of ideology and all the rest, that some of this stuff that you're talking about conservatives melts away. That said, I mean, you look at George H.W. Bush, you look at Reagan, you look at what they did on the Cold War stuff. I mean, they were willing to seize opportunities when they presented themselves. That said, I think you're absolutely right, and it doesn't bother me one whit that conservatives run the risk from time to time of being wrong about big important things. I've said this 1,000 times now in 1,000 different venues. The great shame of modern conservative movement is that we were wrong on the civil rights era.
But is there something inherent in conservatism that may have led to that? Is the question that I'm interested in?
Yes, inability... absolutely. Yes, I mean there is something inherent.
But if I think, bully for you for conceding that, but it seems to me it's a significant problem, isn't it? If in the face of overwhelming injustice, conservatives have to think about trying to figure out the conditions, don't they, in which they're basically willing to make a caveat to their general view that radical, dramatic change is wrong for certain circumstances where we should risk, and it's a risk, we should take the risk of radical, dramatic change because the current status quo is so hideous and that we have to be willing to take a risk in order to try to dramatically change it.
Yeah. Maybe so, but I mean, I think, look, I mean, I've said this a million times. I think one of the biggest, one of the things that conservatism is for, you need libertarians in a room whenever you're going to decide an important issue because you need someone to ask the question, why should government do this?
Mm-hmm.
And conservatives need to be in the room because they're more likely than not to greet 9 out of 10 new ideas by saying that's a bad idea and here's why. And you can go straight through Burke and all of the rest. The argument, conservatives are not against reform, but they're for slow and gradual reform. And occasionally that means you're going to miss the boat. But I don't know why it's such an enormous indictment of conservatism, because you can flip it around and say, you know, that if conservatism has an innate or ideological predisposition towards being skeptical towards sweeping sudden change, which I have and I don't make any apologies for, liberalism has a predisposition or ideological affinity for sudden sweeping change, which is one of the reasons why liberals over the 20th century have been so willing to make apologies for things, for people like Stalin.
And conservatives have been willing to make apologies for apartheid South Africa because they basically lack the capacity to believe that there could ever be rapid, dramatic change in South Africa that would be better. So, I mean...
But Peter, you don't need to get defensive about it. I've already conceded that point about conservatives. My point is that both dispositions come with dangerous Achilles heels. And you had... I mean, we don't need to go back and quote the record from Izzy Stone on down of liberals and leftists who were in love with the idea of revolution, in love with this idea of sweeping change, of starting the world anew, of starting fresh, of being in a perfect world and all the rest, and therefore allowing themselves to be seduced by terrible movements and personalities. So I think there are dangers in either perspective.
Yeah, but I think there are two caveats are necessary. First of all, you said and this is the point we made. You said liberals and leftists, and liberalism is not a revolutionary creed. Liberalism is a more aggressively reformist creed than conservatism is. The differences between conservatives and liberals, certainly in the United States, tend to be about the pace and aggressiveness and risk and of reform, not revolution. So when you there were periods, you know, particularly say during the Depression, where liberalism moved left and kind of began to despair to some degree about and was more open to looking at the alternatives in the Soviet Union. But even then, basically, most of the liberals responded by basically telling people to vote socialist, not by basically going and trying to blow up Congress. So I think that the distinction between liberals and leftists is important. The other distinction is that in the United, I mean, given that American capitalism is itself in some ways a force for dramatic change, I think that the vision of conservatism as being opposed to change, I think the United States, again, this is a familiar point, has to be complicated by the understanding that conservatives are often aligned with this force for enormous change. I mean, it is striking that Gingrich, that we have this thing called the Gingrich Revolution, isn't it? In which Gingrich, you know, maybe you can say that was a libertarian thing and not a conservative thing, but how do we make sense of the idea that people talk about a Reagan Revolution and a Gingrich Revolution? And Gingrich wanted truly dramatic change in a very short period of time.
Yeah, change in how, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff to unpack here. Mm-hmm. First of all, and you'll get different conservatives answering different things on this. So, I mean, this is one of these eternal arguments within conservatism that I love and hold dear, this, you know, conflict between freedom and virtue. Uh-huh. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, NR's position is this fusionist position coined by Frank Meyer, which says that, you know, virtue not freely chosen isn't virtuous. Uh-huh. You cannot compel virtue. And so therefore you have to have people to be free. But in terms of the capitalism thing, you know, a big part of conservatism is in the skepticism towards change and all of the rest has to do with the skepticism towards the ability of what, you know, Burke would call sophisters and calculators, what Hayek would call planners, right, govern and run society from above. I mean, this was the Jacobin temptation, which was, you know, in the extreme version, which was that we can, through the power and force of our intellects, design society in ways that are so much more rational. Let's get rid of, you know, the Catholic Church and create temples of reason and all of this nonsense. And that is where the skepticism towards revolution, the skepticism towards change comes from for a lot of conservatives. A fantastic essay on this, you know, sort of general topic comes from Irving Kristol, I think it was in the 70s, on the American Revolution as a successful revolution. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why, it was a very influential essay on me, one of the reasons why Irving argues that it was a successful revolution is because it took into account this sort of Niebuhrian point that you would call it, of accounting for the flawed nature of man,
uh-huh.
accounting for the pursuit of faction and self-interest and all of the rest, and it didn't try to create new men. It took into account the reality of man as he exists, the crooked timber of humanity, and built a constitution that was revolutionary in its time, but was actually fairly, you know, reformist and practical and incremental in how it actually approached governing. And it maximized freedom and actually used man's freedom as a way to preserve order by pitting faction against faction and divided government and all of the rest. And that is a vision that I think a lot of conservatives are deeply sympathetic to. On your liberal left thing, I mean, we've argued about that a zillion times. I think it's a perfectly fine point. But at the same time, even good, nice, decent liberals have, over time, had a too much sympathy for radical revolutionary change. And sometimes I think when I hear some people making this distinction between liberals and leftists, what they like to do is basically use it as an abracadabra word. And the second the liberals go wrong, they say, oh, well, those were leftists. Those weren't liberals. And the reality is that, you know, if you look at the sort of fashionable, you know, chic of from Che Guevara or the, you know, Tom Friedman's bizarre, you know, obsession with authoritarian capitalism in China to, you know, some of the things that you'll hear from Al Gore and all the rest, I think there is this still abiding sympathy for taking shortcuts to do the great and good things. Sort of gets back to our Supreme Court argument before of going wherever the field, sending the ball wherever the field is open to advance the cause of justice faster than society can necessarily handle it. And and I think, you know, Roe v. Wade was probably a good example of that. But as a general proposition, I'm perfectly willing to count, you know, admit the fact that, and I wish I had them committed to memory because there are lots of quotes about this, that conservatives are occasionally, left behind. That's why Hayek said that, the problem with conservatism is that it has a tendency to be pulled in a direction not of its own choosing. But I think that's a perfectly fine, as long as you're cognizant of this fact and that occasionally there are exceptions to the rule, right? I mean, that's where wisdom is, in understanding where there are exceptions to the rules. But as a general proposition, you know, Lincoln's formulation of conservatism as adherence on the old and tried against the new and untried sits perfectly well with me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, it all has to do, I think, it seems to me, with how significant you think the exceptions are, and whether you think the exceptions basically at a certain point swallow the whole rule. And on the point about liberal, at moments when liberals were most pessimistic about American democracy, or those elements on the left, whether you want to call them liberals or not, I mean, certainly most of them would not have called themselves liberals. If you're talking about the new left, would have slapped you across the face if you called them liberals, as would the old left have. But I think that to the degree that produced sympathy for leftist movements abroad that were trying to produce radical change in oppressive societies, I think one can't take that and then go from there to what a lot of conservatives do, which is say, aha, liberals tend to support dictatorial movements abroad, because there is at least as strong a history, as I think you've acknowledged, of basically conservatives like William F. Buckley, for instance, or Pat Buchanan, showing great sympathy for traditional authoritarian kinds of repressive governments, you know, of the Franco or Marcos schools, for instance. So I think that both sides have in the United States have a history of at various moments being sympathetic to foreign dictatorships or foreign tyrannies.
Again, that's a subject we could get into at length, because I think there are different reasons and motivations for it. And I
think there are different reasons and motivations for it. I agree, but I think the consequences are that there's a long history of conservative sympathy for imperialism and for various forms of authoritarian government.
You have to go case by case, because sympathy versus tolerance or acceptance they're different things. And it seems to me that there is more sympathy on the left for someone like Fidel Castro than there is, certainly on today's right, for any dictator in the world. I mean, the right has basically, whatever truth there was to that analysis, and there was some truth to it, the right has become more Reaganite than Reagan in many respects, and has, you can't say it has any sympathy for, dictatorial, monarchical, and authoritarian regimes anywhere in the world now. It may not argue to do anything about them, but then there are a lot of liberals who make that argument these days. There's very little ideological affinity in the way you'll find on among almost any campus leftist, and what you'll find with someone like Castro.
Well, I think this is a case where you can't just, I don't even really know how much sympathy there is on any campus these days for Fidel Castro, but certainly you know when you're talking about liberals in Washington D.C., I'm really hard pressed to find anyone who has any sympathy for Fidel Castro. It's true that I think that given that unlike in the even as late as the 1980s of the Cold War, where basically I think conservatives were very, very sympathetic to authoritarian American Cold War allies like Marcos, for instance, or Pinochet. What's happened is a lot of those governments have democratized, and also a lot of them are simply not involved in any kind of struggle where we feel we need their help. Mm-hmm. But I do think there still is a conservative tendency to believe that when countries are on our side in some kind of struggle that we really care about, we should look the other way in terms of their human rights violations. It's not a question, even if, and I think that, you know, because we simply can't, because we have to deal with the greater threat. And I think that tendency still tends to exist. And I think it's why you tend to see conservatives basically always downplaying human rights issues as it relates to Israel, for instance. Because I think there's a conservative tendency, basic tendency to believe that if a country is basically on our side in some big struggle, we should basically not quibble with them. We should basically be in solidarity with them.
There's just too many caveats to get into, I think it's a perfectly defensible position, even though, you know, I mean, the sort of liberal realism schools I find to be sort of even more problematic, you know, when I read this stuff about foreign policy. But anyway, you had another quote. Do we have time?
I'll just say it quickly, and then you can – the quote's from John Dewey. Dewey says – it's kind of the flip side. Dewey says it is no longer enough for a principle to be hallowed by time. It must present its birth certificate. It must show under just what conditions of human experience it was generated, and must justify by itself its worth, present, or potential. And so, I mean, it seems to me this is really exactly the flip side of the argument. Basically, the idea that it's not enough for a principle, for something to have been around for a long time. We have to try to understand how it was created and show what good it's doing for society in the present.
Yeah, and
which I would imagine you're violently opposed to.
Yeah, no, I think Dewey was in many ways one of the most destructive philosophers of the 20th century, and I despise him. In part because, and I'll just say this as a general proposition that I've never heard anybody dispute who's actually tried to read Dewey, the guy is frickin' unreadable.
He is unreadable. I completely agree with you.
That is one of the most cogent sentences I've ever heard from Dewey.
I have to truncate it a little bit. He's a terrible writer. I totally agree with you.
I mean, and to me, that's more unforgivable than anything else. But, look, Dewey is a good example. Dewey was one of these guys who, I take it you see as a liberal philosopher and, you know, an exemplar of liberalism, who in the late 1920s went off to the Soviet Union as one of the pilgrims of the Soviet Union and loved the place.
Yeah, but you got to be fair, Jonah. He also presided over the. He also had a big, big falling out with the communists in the 1930s because he was very,
sure.
very hot. He was very, very tough on Stalin. He presided over the trial of Trotsky, where he basically.
I'm perfectly willing to concede that, but Peter, that sort of proves my point, right? Which is that that generation of liberals was perfectly willing to give the benefit of the doubt to something new and revolutionary without thinking it through. And then because Dewey was a smart guy, you know, and the evidence started coming in, evidence which a lot of his contemporaries ignored, for the record, like the former editor of the New Republic, Henry Wallace, he said, wait a second, this is all gone off the rails. But if he had been a little more conservative, a little bit more Burkean in his understanding of things, he might have listened to what the Bolsheviks were saying, what Lenin was saying in 1920, and said, this can only lead to no good. And yet, you know, that's exactly, you know, that's what Bertrand Russell did. Bertrand Russell was a good liberal and all the rest, and he said, this is crazy talk. But Dewey, because he really did believe in this sort of, you know, we can exhume our institutions from their soil and plan things rationally, approach those things, he was very sympathetic at first, and it took a lot of evidence for him to finally change his mind about the Soviet Union, and congratulations to him for doing it. But, you know, back in the 1920s, what they were doing in the Soviet Union, and I've read a lot of that stuff, was hailed by, you know, the Whole House crowd as the best, fullest application of Deweyan principles in the world. And I think that there is a vulnerability there. And as a general proposition, you know, I think Hayek just crushes Dewey. Because Hayek, who, you know, in many ways was much more of a revolutionary, open-minded, you know, guy than Dewey was, and, you know, I mean, he was sort of founding father of libertarianism in many respects, but at the same time, Dewey understood that individuals can't be smart enough to understand all the aspects of hidden knowledge, all the aspects of social capital invested in our institutions, and that there's an incredible hubris and arrogance that comes in Dewey, who thinks that he can, simply by the application of his own intellect, figure out all the reasons why we have certain institutions, all the reasons why we should keep certain institutions. And if he's not persuaded, then the case hasn't been made for an entire institution. And that was the problem with all those pragmatists in the 1920s, is they just basically saw the 19th century and even the 18th century constitution as so much as sort of a desk that if it couldn't be defended in the vocabulary of the 1920s progressivism or 1920s liberalism, then it couldn't be defended and should be thrown aside, and we should replan it from scratch. And that is sort of what I consider myself to be fundamentally philosophically opposed to.
Well, I think that, you know, Dewey was talking I don't think you're setting up Dewey as if he believes he should be the kind of czar doing it himself. I mean, Dewey believed that a democratic citizenry should be able to reconsider these things. I do happen to agree that I think, you know, one of the reasons I'm a little bit more sympathetic to kind of 1940s and 50s liberalism is I think there was a spirit of a kind of hubris of early 20th century, and in some ways not just liberalism. I mean, I think the whole intellectual ethos, even on the right in early 20th century America, was probably overly optimistic about the idea of progress, whether people believed that it was going to be progress run through through a dramatic change in capitalism, or those who simply believed that capitalism itself was going to basically constantly lead to kind of brighter and brighter horizons. So I I'm sympathetic to, but I think it's a little bit unfair to suggest as if Dewey imagined this would happen in some authoritarian way.
Well, I mean, look, but the problem is how do you define authoritarian? Because there was a lot of stuff in the, you know, that was done in the name of science, but was really what Hayek would call scientism. You know, sort of using science as this rationalization for other things that went on all around Dewey. And, you know, I looked very hard when I was writing my book for evidence that Dewey was a eugenicist, and I never found it, to his credit. But a lot of his best friends were real eugenicists. I mean, like hardcore, serious devotees of both positive and negative eugenics. And I also found no evidence that he denounced any of that. Now, I may hear from some reader some viewer who will show me one way or the other, and I'd be really interested in seeing it. But it seems to me that's a good example of what I was getting at before of the enthusiasm for sweeping sudden progress, allowing liberals to overlook bad things, is just as much a problem with liberalism as the problem of conservatism has for willing to tolerate bad things for fear that fixing them will make them worse.
Well, I think those are the twin dangers, and I think you're right. The fundamental question is where people feel like the greater danger lies in acting too rashly or in not acting at all. And as I always say when we have these debates, the part of the liberal fear of not acting at all is, in fact, the fear that, that by not acting at all, you will have much more dangerous revolutionary change than if you act more aggressively within the context of an existing democratic framework. So
I think that's why I like to call you a Bismarckian liberal, but we'll have that argument another day.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
It was great talking to you again, Peter. I got to run. I got to catch a train. And
all right.
Hopefully we can do this again.
Terrific. Take care.
Later, man.